right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. God, it's great to be here today. But I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time fooling around. Getting to the show today, what we got lined up for you is this. At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Gary Blasi and Peter Shea, two attorneys who are involved, deeply involved in, have a lot to say about what's going on with the homeless in LA and the assault on the homeless that is picking up speed as we sit here and speak. All right. And before that, we'll be talking with Chris Silva, whose brother David Silva was murdered by the Bakersfield police. And before that, we're going to jump right into this. We're going to be speaking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're just going to jump right into this section of the show. So here it is, Carl Dix. All right. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Carl Dix. He's a frequent guest on the show, and he's a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're going to be talking with Carl about the struggle beginning now to mobilize tens of thousands of people for Rise Up October, 3 days of action to stop police terror, which begins in New York, okay, beginning in New York on October 24th. And the days, actually, the 3 days begin on October 22nd. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure, man. Well, let's jump into this so we can get as much out of the time we have, all right? Let's talk about this. Tell people what this Rising Up October is. And then we can talk about this. There was a meeting, a big meeting in New York City back in late June, which pulled together about 150 people determined to actually make this a major stamp on society in the next few months. Let's talk about what it is and what's going on.
Yeah, what it is, as you said, October 24th, there's going to be a national march to stop police terror in New York City. We're going to mobilize tens of thousands of people from around the country. They'll descend on New York City, and they will join tens of thousands of people in the New York area, delivering a message that police getting away with terrorizing and murdering people is unacceptable, and it must stop, and that there is a large force of people who are determined to stop it. We have begun the effort to build for this now, and in fact, I'm going to be going on tour. The Rise Up October is going to be going on tour, not just me. We've got a crew of people coming from New York, from Dayton, maybe even some from out in California who are going to Cleveland next week. And we're going to bring this message of which side are you on? Are you on the side of people who are standing up to join the struggle to stop these horrors, or is it okay with you that they happen and continue to happen? Because that's what we're up against. We're at a very crucial moment in society, and one where the resistance to police getting away with murdering people, to police getting away with brutalizing people, has to be taken to a much higher level.
Now, you've been talking about for quite a while this, you know, there's been a steady growing fight, particularly since, you know, what happened in Ferguson and then everything that sort of seemed to just roll out. And you got to wonder, was this actually, you know, just sort of something that was increasing in the aftermath of this, sort of the police murders and all this, or the stuff that was uncovered or a gate was opened up and let loose so people could see this a lot more. But there's been a steady growing fight ever since Ferguson first erupted. Why at this meeting did people come together and see that this kind of 3 days culminating in this massive march in New York City, why did they see that as the very necessary next step?
Well, it's a necessary step because from one end, like you say, since Ferguson, since last year, there has been an outpouring of resistance. Virtually every time one of these killings by police come to light, every time a killer cop gets exonerated, people take to the streets in protest. That's been very important, and it's been on a level that we haven't seen in decades. But at the same time, the killings continue. The legal system continues to exonerate the killer cops. Mouthpieces for the system continue to justify these killings. They try to change the story from police brutalizing and killing people to cops being heroes who have a difficult job, a dangerous job, and are doing it well. Since the Charleston massacre, we've got a lot of talk coming that people who are victimized by white supremacists or by the police need to forgive those who are victimizing them, need to come together with them. And all of this is aimed at suppressing the resistance and keeping this horror going. And if we keep things at the level of responding to outrage by outrage, we won't be able to keep the resistance going, because it'll begin to reach the point where it'll hit people that, look, we've done all of this and these killings have continued. What we have to do is we have to go to another level. We have to work to bring together an outpouring of people from many different backgrounds, people of different races and nationalities, who come together and say, this is unacceptable, and there is a large and growing force that refuses to accept this any longer. And through doing that, draw a very sharp dividing line in society, challenging millions of people to open their eyes to what's really going on, to stop trying to sleepwalk past it, and to confront it and to challenge them with the question of which side are you on? Because there really is no neutral middle ground. Mm-hmm. If you see these horrors for what they are, and you got an ounce of humanity, then you need to join in the resistance to them. You need to stand up and stand together with people to stop them. And if you refuse to do that, then you're saying it's okay with you for this to happen, and you're on the wrong side of this. So we want to take that question around the country. That's why we're going on tour, starting in Cleveland. We're going to be going into the Midwest, into Chicago. We're going to be in the Ferguson, St. Louis area around August 9th, 1 year since the murder of Michael Brown, taking this dividing line question, which side are you on, and challenging people to get on the right side of it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking about the struggle to mobilize tens of thousands of people for Rise Up October, 3 days of action to stop police terror, and particularly focusing around, culminating in a massive march in New York City on October 24th. Now, Carl, let's talk about this a little bit more. This whole issue of, you know, I know that in a lot of what you have written about since the 30th, you've spoken a lot to Charleston, in addition to the sort of the uniformed police murder. Then you have this other thing that's going on, and it seems to be increasing, the whole idea of around the Confederate flag, all these other things coming up, which is really sort of, you know, bringing together, coalescing this other sort of ununiformed arm of this repressive network that has been coming down on people for so harshly for centuries, actually. So let's talk about this, because that also brings up this question that you have on the one hand Charleston, then there was also a big thing that came out around that with, like, Obama getting up and talking about, well, we need to have forgiveness. People need to, you know, try and embrace the people and understand that you have to forgive and sort of move on from there. What do you have to say about that?
Well, okay, we're on radio. That is just poisonous. I mean, look, first off, let's be real clear. Charleston was an example of America, of this white supremacy that has always said that black lives do not matter. And the same white supremacy that is behind the unleashing of the police to brutalize and even murder, especially black and Latino people, it's all of a package, and people need to see that relationship. Then here's the other thing. Forgiving, coming together with those who carry out these kinds of attacks and those who preside over them while these attacks continue to come down, is like saying that we will continue to suffer these attacks. And the oppressors, the brutalizers, are the only ones who are served by people practicing forgiveness and reconciliation. The real deal is that these horrors must stop. I mean, we have to see this for what it is. The police being unleashed, white supremacists being unleashed, you know, the murder of Trayvon Martin, the murder of Jordan Davis, now the massacre in Charleston. All of this coming down is actually a concentration point of an overall genocidal attack on black and Latino people in this country, and I do not choose that term lightly. Genocide is actually putting a group of people in whole or in part in conditions where they're not able to survive and thrive as a people. And that's what's going on when you look at the way that law enforcement is unleashed to go into the ghettos and barrios of this country. When you look at the way that blacks and Latinos are disproportionately dragged into court, warehoused in prison, then treated like second-class citizens once they get out, put that together with the other debilitating attacks, and you've got people who are put in situations where they cannot survive and thrive as people. And you have tens of millions of people who are being subjected to all this. We cannot sit by and say that that's okay. Nor can we talk about forgiveness and reconciliation in the face of all that. Nor can we say that moves that smooth the edges on it or reduce these horrors incrementally are dealing with the problem. All of this is coming together. We're being told to forgive and come together with the oppressors. We're being told that some small incremental steps are things that we should, you know, praise, things like Obama commuting the sentences of 46 people who were in jail for long periods of time, decades in some cases, for simple possession of illegal drugs, when there are tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, who are in jail for long periods of time for those kinds of charges. So 46 people being let out is a drop in the bucket, less than a drop in the bucket. We actually have to deal with the fact that people have been demonized and criminalized because they were black or brown. People have been warehoused in prison, been targeted by vicious police terror, and this has to stop. It doesn't need to be reduced a little bit. It doesn't need to have the edges shaved off of it. And people should not forgive and forget. People need to stand up and say, we're not taking this anymore. Those who aren't targeted by it, but who see that it's happening, need to come together with those who are targeted. You can't stand aside from it because you don't think it'll target you. Because if you do that in the process, you're surrendering your humanity.
Carl, this is very heavy, man. And actually, you know, I keep thinking about this because why Cleveland? Why are you starting this tour in Cleveland? And then I have a follow-up question after that.
Okay, well, there are a lot of places that we could go. Cleveland presented itself for several reasons. One is it's the place where police murdered Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy who had a toy gun, and the police rolled up on him and within 2 seconds had shot him dead. It's also the place where police fired 137 shots at Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams after their car backfired and executed them, you know. And then the cops who were involved in that have all been exonerated. So that's one reason that we had to go to Cleveland, and we decided to time it as the first place because there's also a gathering of the Black Lives Matter movement there next week. So we're going to go in the middle of the week. We're going to go into the projects. We're going to go into, campuses. There's a campus we're going to go to. We're going to go out among all kinds of people in Cleveland with the message of Rise Up October, Stop Police Terror, which side are you on? And then we're going to take the opportunity to take it into the conference of the Black Lives Matter conference and take the same message to them to get with this movement in October. I mean, look, just this morning I Googled black woman killed in police custody because I had heard about this case of the woman in Texas. But I didn't Google Texas. I just Googled black woman killed in police custody. When I did this Google search, in addition to the woman in Texas, Sandra Bland, who was killed last earlier this week in police custody. Cases came up of two black women in Brooklyn who were killed in police custody, a black woman in Mississippi who was killed in police custody, Shaniqua Porter, a black woman in Alexandria, Florida, who was killed in police custody. And that was just the first page of the search. This is a widespread, overwhelming problem, the problem of police murdering black and Latino people. Most often it targets men, but it also targets women as well. We have to act to stop it, and we have to take the message that this needs to happen everywhere in the country. So that's why we're going to start with Cleveland, you know, because of what's been happening in Cleveland and the fact that there's this conference that we could also connect with. But we're going to go from there. We're going into Chicago. We're going to the St. Louis Ferguson area. And we're setting up other sites. And people who want to, you know, be a part of that, want to help make it happen, want to join it or want it to come to their city, you know, should get in touch and get involved. They could go to the brand new website for October, Rise Up October. They could also go to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network website, or they could go to the RevCom site, because all of those sites will be carrying information about what's going on with the Rise Up October tour and letting people know how they can get involved.
And that's RevCom.us for
yes,
people.
Yes, RevCom.us.
Right, okay. Now, one of the things, and we're running up on our time, but I want to let people know that we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the upcoming Rise Up October, 3 days of actions to stop police terror, and it's in New York, and especially culminating in a massive demonstration in New York City on October 24th. Now, Carl, let's talk about this. Why is the proposal that you guys came up with in this meeting to concentrate on these 3 days in New York City?
Yeah, we decided to concentrate on these 3 days, the 3 days being October 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. October 22nd is the National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. I was a co-founder of that mobilization back in 1996, and it has become a day when people take to the streets to stop the horror of police murder. It falls on a Thursday this year, and we decided, well, we didn't want to not mark that day, but the national day, the day that people need to come together from everywhere, needed to be a weekend. So we did that on a Saturday so that more people would be able to come. And we decided, let's just make all 3 days. October 22nd is going to be a day when people act in cities all around the country to demand that police murder stop. But then people are going to descend on New York City for October 24th, the National March. And then people in New York City are going to engage in some significant nonviolent direct action on Friday, October 23rd. We wanted to do this in New York City, which is really an international city, because we wanted to reach the eyes of the world. We wanted to deliver a message to the whole country, but also a message to the world that there's a large section of people who are determined to stop these horrors, and that's what we're going to do on October 24th, culminating, you know, the 3 days of activity. Mm-hmm. And again, stop police terror, which side are you on? That's the message that we're taking to the whole country and to the world in the lead up to that day and on that day itself.
All right, well, that gets me to a couple more questions. I mean, last week we took a lot of phone calls talking about this particular subject. And some people, I wanted to pose just generally some of the questions that people put, because you've spoken to them, but I think it's important to actually make it clear. People were asking things like, well, how broad are you really going to unite people with this action? And then a lot of people were saying, what can white people do? You know, is there a role for white people in this? And then what do you do if you're not in New York City?
Okay. Three good questions. First off, how broad do we want to go? Everybody who sees police being unleashed to brutalize and even murder people and then exonerated when their murderous deeds are brought to light, everybody who sees that as a problem, and anybody whose eyes get open to that between now and October is welcomed, encouraged, and challenged to join this movement, because that's how broad it needs to be. Everybody who sees this as a problem needs to act around it, which also leads me into the second question. What about white people? Well, if they see this as a problem, then they need to act on this too. Because I've made the point that this overwhelmingly targets black and Latino people, but what that means is that white people are also gunned down and brutalized by the police. But even if you're pretty sure that it's not going to hit you, that does not justify not getting involved. You see horror coming down, you see injustice like this, then you have a responsibility as a human being to stand against it. And look, I know that there are voices in the movement who say that the only people who have agency around particular kinds of injustice are those who are suffering that injustice, and people who aren't suffering it would be taking the agency away from others if they acted on it. Well, I don't buy that. I do not want to own my oppression, and I do not want to see anybody else trying to own their oppression. I want to see us all standing up, standing together, and acting to end oppression. That is where I've been coming from for decades. I mean, you told people at the top of the show I'm a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we see all of the horrors coming down on people here in this country and around the world stemming from the nature of this capitalist imperialist system, the very way that it works. I've spoken to that a lot. I can't get into it in detail, but people in relation to this question of the criminal injustice system could check out a talk that I gave titled Mass Incarceration Plus Silence Equals Genocide. Act to Stop It Now. So we want to see everybody come together, and we think, in fact, that a view that says that white people can only be allies of people of color who are the ones who have agency, which then goes a step further and says, well, really, black people have agency around what happens to black people, and any other people then are reduced to the level of allies. That slicing and dicing things is actually weakening the movement of resistance. So if you're white, if you're black, if you're Latino, if you're indigenous, that's not the question I want to ask. My question is, are you a human being? And if you're a human being, your humanity demands that you see this injustice for what it is and join the fight against it. And it's the same for all of the injustices, frankly. I mean, this is focused around the terror the police bring down, but we're also saying to people who were formerly incarcerated that they should come and bring their voice. The people who have relatives, loved ones who are incarcerated should come with pictures of their incarcerated loved ones. We've gone to people who are fighting against the attacks that come down on women, the right, you know, trying to strip them of the right to have abortions, violence against women. People who are fighting against that, they need to bring their voices. We're going to take this to people involved in the environmental movement. We're going to take it to people trying to deal with the attacks coming down on immigrants, so that all of this can be brought together. Its focus is going to remain on police terror, but more and more we have to be working together to stop all of these horrors that this system brings down. And of course, I'm going to be bringing out the message that it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end these horrors once and for all. And we in the Revolutionary Communist Party are building a movement for revolution. We've got the leadership for it in Bob Avakian, the leader of the party. We've got an understanding and a strategy for it. And people who want to see all of this mess stop need to get with this movement for revolution. I'm going to be taking that out even as we focus on. And the point of unity for this effort is going to be stop police terror. Which side are you on? Finally and briefly, because I went a little longer than I thought, what if you're not in New York City? Well, what we want to say is The first thing is, if you're not in New York City, can you get to New York City and can you bring a lot of people with you? Can you connect with people and organize buses to take people to New York City? Can you get a church that you're affiliated with or that you know of to rent buses to bring people to New York City? Can you get a union, a labor union that you're a part of or you know of, to rent buses to bring people to New York City? Can you pull together an organizing committee in your area, in your city, or on your campus that can put together transportation to bring people here? Because this march in New York City on October 24th has got to be like the 1963 March on Washington without it getting sidetracked into supporting legislation in Congress, because that ain't what this is about. We're not trying to get some piece of legislation done to round the edges on this. Our demand is simple. Stop unleashing your cops to kill us, and we're going to flood into New York City with that demand and continue beyond October 24th, continuing to raise it, but making a huge leap in drawing a dividing line around this and saying that it must stop. That's what this has got to be. It's historic that it's happening, and people got to be there, and they're actually going to want to be there when they begin to understand this. And it's going to be the kind of thing where you would want to be able to tell people that when this thing went down, I was there. Now, for people who can't get there, okay, then there will be do something where you are, but the main thing is try to get there. Try to get representatives from your area there. We want to get a lot of people who have suffered the horror of having a loved one killed by the police there. We want to get people who have been brutalized themselves by the police in New York City. We want to have living representation of the problem that we're talking about acting to stop, and we want to have many, many people from many different backgrounds there standing together with those who have felt the sting of police bullets and billy clubs.
All right, Carl, and real quick, just because we're really running out of time now, but I want to actually get real quick. I'm sure there's a hell of a lot to do between now and October. All right, so what can people do, and where do they go to find out what they can do?
Okay, what they can do is, one, get organized, because it's going to take an organized effort to make this happen, both getting people into New York City, getting the word out all across the country. So get organized. Form a committee for Rise Up October in your city, in your neighborhood, on your campus. Funds are going to be definitely needed. Work on raising funds. You can find out how to plug into this, again, by going to the website riseupoctober.org. You could also find out by going to the Stop Mass Incarceration website, which is stopmassincarceration.net. And you could find out what's going on around this and what's happening with the Movement for Revolution that I talked about by going to the website revcom.us.
Now, that site revcom.us is also where people can find the speech you referred to of yours?
Yeah, I believe it could be found. The link to it could be found there.
Okay, great. Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us, and look forward to talking to you again real soon, man.
Okay. Right. Same here, Michael. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Take care, man. All right. You've just been listening to a conversation I had with Carl Dix a little earlier today. And Carl Dix is from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we've been talking about Rise Up October. And I'm sure we'll be talking about that a lot more as the months go along. Right now, I want to bring on to the show a person who I've admired the stuff that he's been doing for quite some time. I initially interviewed his dad on the occasion of the murder of his brother. We're going to be talking with Chris Silva, brother of David Silva, who was murdered by Kern County Sheriffs and California Highway Patrol on May 8th in 2013. Chris, welcome to the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You know, Chris, I wanted to ask you this because we don't have a whole lot of time, but what brought you? You recently wrote a statement about your support for Rise Up October. And I want to ask you, what brought you into the fight to stop police murder?
Well, obviously, my brother. You know, my brother was killed in over 2 years ago for over 20 minutes by 9 officers and a canine dog. A man named reaching out to me. He's part of the Revolution Communist Movement. And we're pretty much good friends now because he's kind of one of those, you know, one of those people that kind of stayed with me, is actually keeping contact and educate me about the what's been happening, you know, in terms of what's happening in terms of police brutality. So, you know, I was informed of an event of October 24th, and I'm ready for it. You know, definitely very intrigued by it, and I'm definitely motivated to be there in New York.
Now, one of the things that, you know, when you talk about how your brother was murdered, one of the things that happened, I know your family has put in a long fight around this. And I saw you back on April 14th in Los Angeles, and you were, you know, talking about what a dramatic impact it had on your life. And I know in your statement, you recently wrote a statement in support of the Rise Up October. And you talked movingly about how a lot of times that the system offers people money, offers the families money, and it's offered to the families of those killed by the police. And you talked about how this is not justice and people shouldn't be fooled into thinking it is. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, we're in a civil trial right now. My family is a civil trial. I just lost my dad. My dad passed away 2 months ago, a little over 2 months ago. My dad died. You know, you did an interview with him. You know, it had a huge impact in my life. You know, the loss of my brother has had a huge impact in my parents' lives. You know, that you know, I've already lost my dad. It's taken a toll. You know, not only did I lose my brother, I lost my dad. So there's a lot that goes on behind closed doors that people don't see. I had my own deposition in my brother's case about 2 weeks ago, and it just didn't seem, you know, for them, they're looking to put a price on my brother's head. You know, they basically put a value on the life of my brother and how much he was worth and how much they, you know, basically in questions. That's what it's about. And the civil trial is dated for May 10th. Of next year, 2016, almost three years exactly since he passed away. And we're not going to, you know, my mom and I work very hard. And the idea is, and working with, you know, Keith James, is never settle. You know, settling is a trick. It's a game because we have to, you know, we know from the very beginning accountability of these officers has to happen. And that's what we're striving for.
Now, you said that in this overall fight that you felt that October 22nd through the 24th this year, Rise Up October, is pivotal. Why?
I think it's pivotal because we need, you know, you heard Carl talk, and a concentration full in an organized fashion needs to happen. There has to be a movement that people can see that there's a problem here, especially nationally across the globe. People need to know that people also care enough to get people organized in one location, in order for people to understand that nothing has changed. You know, Eric Garner died a year ago, and nothing has changed. You know, what is, you know, David Silva died, you know, over two years ago, but nothing has changed. You know, the conversation is here, but no one's doing anything about it. You don't see officers being locked up too much. You know, you don't see them, except maybe in Baltimore. I'm hoping, especially October 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, especially, people can see that there's an issue, there's a problem, and it's growing, and we're getting bigger. So I think when you see October happen, you'll see a rise. You'll see a rise for a reason. It's not because people are having fun. This is not a social event. We're trying to go against something that's literally killing us.
Now, Chris, one more question. And, you know, some people have asked me, as I tell them about this, what they should do when they face up to the fact they don't live in New York City. And I thought your answer, that you're going wherever you're needed because there's a big problem to be solved, police murder has to stop, was the way to answer that. What do you have to say to people that say, what do I do if I don't live in New York City?
Well, I live in Bakersfield, one of the most conservative towns in the world, and they're still into their old ways, their cowboy ways. Start your own rally. You can have a rally in your own town. Be empowered to start your own rally. Do it for the right reasons. Do it with the right cause. Team up with people that have been doing it. You don't have to be in New York. If you can't be in New York, you can't afford to be in New York, start a rally. Be at your local police stations, your sheriff stations, CHP, to find out who's been getting killed. If you're not affected, you will be affected, so do something about it.
Well, the other part that you raised too, though, and I thought this was really inspiring, is you said, I'm going to New York, and I'm going to bring people with me. And I think that is actually, because, you know, it's true. Wherever you are, you've got to do something. But at the same time, do you think that this idea of getting to New York and being part of this day that's going to change the whole, it's going to draw a very sharp dividing line around which side are you on? Is that important for people to go to from wherever they are?
It is. It's important. People need to know that they should not be afraid. You know, people are afraid to be a stand up against something like this. They're standing up. We're standing up against people that have guns pointed at us. How come we are not afraid? You know, don't be afraid. Feel empowered. There are people with you. We're here to protect you. But don't be afraid to stand up against what's wrong.
All right, Chris Silva, thank you very much. We're going to have you back again soon, man, to keep on talking about this, all right?
All right. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Take care, Chris. All right. We've just been talking with Chris Silva, who's the brother of David Silva, who was murdered by Kern County Sheriffs and California Highway Patrol on May 8th, 2013 in Bakersfield, California. And this is the first time I heard that Chris's father, Sal Silva, who I had actually interviewed back when it happened, shortly after the murder, is dead now, has passed away. And, you know, people got to think about this, man. When somebody like Chris Silva gets up and tells you that he's going to be in New York and why it's important, people should sit up and listen for a minute. All right. And all over the country now, there's going to be all kinds of things going on. All over the country, there's going to be all kinds of demonstrations, all kinds of things happening. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Gary Blasi, the attorney Gary Blasi, about what's going on with the attack on the homeless now in Los Angeles. All right, so stay tuned.
Yeah, you could call a man a bum with disgust on your morning run, 'cause he lives outside in the street you don't notice. But you fail to realize that the one you so despise reflects yourself, 'cause every black man is homeless. You could take your Alka-Seltzer while you talk about shelter. You might even want to talk about a little loan, 'cause no matter how rich you become, you'll always be two, not one. 'Cause believe it or not, America ain't your home. We've been taught to say...
All right, welcome back. And for all you old heads out there, I know you're all sitting there and you're nodding your head and you're loving it, because who is that? KRS-One. And what is it? It's Edutainment, and it's a song called Homeless. All right? Joining us now to talk about the assault on the homeless in Los Angeles today is Gary Blasi, a professor of law emeritus at UCLA, who's been an advocate and researcher on homeless issues in LA since 1983, and Peter Shea, who's the president and executive director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law Foundation, and he's been the director of that since 1980. Gary, Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, let's jump into this because I want to get as much done. You guys wouldn't believe it. I had a list of about 25 questions for you, okay? So, Gary, revisions to the city's municipal code that make it easier to seize and destroy the belongings of homeless people. There's been a whole lot of talk about that happening. It's impending. You've described these new laws as draconian. What's going on with this now, and what do you mean by draconian?
Well, these laws, if you just read them, which I sometimes wonder whether either the city attorney or the city council members who voted 12-1 for them are pretty astonishing. They say that unless you can carry everything you have on your back and the police cite you for having something that's on public property, either a sidewalk or a park, and they see your stuff on public property anywhere in the city 24 hours later, then they can seize everything that will fit into a 60-gallon garbage can and everything else they can destroy.
You're saying that it doesn't matter whether you're there or you're not there. If you're standing right next to your stuff, they can still come over and just haul it away, and tough luck.
They can just take it away, and there will be police officers and presumably other city employees driving trucks for the carting away of people's property. So, yeah, it won't matter whether you're there or not. It won't matter whether you move it across the street or across town. If it's still in the city of Los Angeles and it's on public property, it's subject to seizure.
Yeah.
So your only options are either to levitate yourself off the surface of the earth or move to another city or just keep walking.
Yeah. That's incredible. So draconian and a campaign of force and intimidation when you think about this in the way that it's happening. It's just so people know, you're talking about, what's this, the area of Los Angeles, like 486 square miles, something like that?
L.A. City is about 486 square miles. L.A. County is a little over 4,000.
Oh, okay. Okay. But you're looking at, I mean, this is phenomenal. Nowhere in the city can they go where their stuff would then be safe. Now, there were other laws that were thrown in here, too, other parts of this bill. And where do they stand now, where it was actually where people could be charged with a misdemeanor in relation to their goods being seized? Is that still on the books?
Yeah, the law actually takes legal effect on July the 18th. As of tomorrow, everything I just described will constitute a misdemeanor and subject you to a $1,000 fine and or 6 months in jail, in addition to the loss of all of your property. So that part of the law, the literal criminalization, is still there. Even if the misdemeanor penalties are removed, it works out to be roughly the same thing, because what they're talking about now, maybe through amendment, is to remove the misdemeanor penalty but still allow the police to write a citation. Of course, if you're homeless or even just extremely poor, you get a citation, and these are for upwards of $170. You don't pay it, you're still subject to arrest for the warrant that issued when you didn't pay the citation. So either it's a direct trip to jail or a more circuitous route to jail. But it's criminalization either way.
Wow, wow. Peter, welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you. Appreciate
sure,
it.
Sure. Peter, you work a lot with immigrants on Skid Row, and I imagine with people in general, but a lot with immigrants. Can you give us a sense of the overall numbers of people we're talking about on Skid Row?
Yeah, it's very large. Currently, the shelter shortfall in Los Angeles is anticipated to be approximately 70%, and upwards of 70%. Last year, it was predicted at being about 52%. So that means that in this year, roughly 70% of people who need housing are not going to find housing. The numbers, the actual numbers, hard numbers, are difficult to pin down. Los Angeles Services, Homeless Services Authority, puts the number at approximately 45,000 homeless in L.A. County. Other private groups have put it at closer to 85,000. Obviously, what we see here is basically the social imprisonment of a third world population, partially people of color. The homelessness and lack of affordable housing in Los Angeles clearly has a disparate racial impact, which we think is in violation of the United States obligations under the International Convention on Racial Discrimination. A large part of their population consists of immigrants, both unaccompanied minors, a very large number of unaccompanied minors, and other recently arrived immigrant families. There's no doubt that they will suffer enormously as a result of this new policy, not only in the sense that their property will be seized and will be put at some downtown location that many, many of these homeless folks couldn't reach. They wouldn't know where it is. They wouldn't have the funds to take a bus to get there. And this facility tends to keep bankers' hours. So once that property is seized, it's pretty much gone for those people. And there will also be a collateral impact on immigration status, in the sense that when people are cited, people are arrested, that tends to go into databases. The federal immigration authorities have access to those databases. And if and when some of these folks are eligible to apply to legalize their status, they're going to run into obstacles in that they can be denied legalization of status if it appears that they're likely to become a public charge in the future. And if somebody has several of these citations or arrests or jail sentences on their records, and that appears in the federal databases, which it will, that will create an obstacle to many of these people ultimately legalizing their status. So there are multiple problems with the approach that Los Angeles is a sort of enforcement approach that Los Angeles is taking, rather than creating what cities like New York and other cities have done, which was to, in essence, create a right to shelter for every man, woman, and child to address this problem.
Now, Peter, one question around this in relation to the immigrants. Is there a large immigrant population of homeless? I mean, I'm curious about that, because, you know, you tend to see in neighborhoods where there are a lot of immigrants there generally, that you also do tend to see a number of people who are living on the streets. And I don't know if that's also true in Skid Row, that there's a large immigrant population in Skid Row. But how big is this question of homelessness among the immigrant population?
It's very significant, and it's increasing as a result of the failure of the federal government, the administration, the Obama administration, and the Congress to seriously grapple with the question of comprehensive immigration reform. And so what we see as we have economic dislocation in Mexico, in Central America, we have the aftermath of the wars that the U.S. basically conducted in Central America. We have deportation of alleged gang members and increasing gang violence in Central America, all resulting of coffee crop failures, all resulting in families coming to the United States, unaccompanied minors coming to the United States, with no real path to citizenship, without employment authorization, if they're lucky enough to be working at all, working in highly exploitable jobs at the minimum wage or less than the minimum wage. And a person in Los Angeles working at minimum wage, it is well known, cannot even afford a one-bedroom apartment. So I would say that probably 30% of the population of homeless people in Los Angeles is made up of immigrants. They're largely ineligible for government-funded social services. Many of them, I was dealing with a young man yesterday who used to reside at a homeless youth shelter that we operate, and he's unable to even get a bed to sleep in because he does not have a photo identification. So there are any number of problems that of course the homeless face, and those tend to be doubled. Those problems are doubled and tripled when it comes to the immigrant members of the community who are homeless.
Gary, let me ask you this. You know, a number of years ago, this was a number of years back, and it was the first year that I started doing this show. There were all these nighttime raids being pulled on homeless people, especially in Skid Row, and they were really vicious. As I interviewed people, they told me about being savagely beaten in the night, feeling a club coming down on their tent and then coming out and being clubbed down as they were doing it, and scared the hell out of them, basically. And it was really meant to do this campaign of force and intimidation that you've referred to earlier. And this whole, in terms of talking about this as a draconian law, that reminded me then of the kind of things I saw when I was in South Africa, when the squatter camps were being broken up by the apartheid police force there. Is that sort of something, the direction that things are heading in now?
Well, they've been not only heading there, but they've been there for some time. The really heavy militarization of police in Skid Row began in 2006 as a project of Mayor Villaraigosa, who promised police and services and delivered police in huge quantities, but no services. Raising South Africa makes it imperative that I mention one fact that's been not very well portrayed in the media or even discussed anywhere, and that is that in the 2 years between 2013 and 2015, the percentage of overall of homeless people rose 12%, but for African Americans, that number rose by 35%. And for whites, it went down by 30%. It's now the case that one out of every 22 African-American people in the city of Los Angeles is homeless. Compared to the rest of the population, that number is one in 254. So there is an intense racial dynamic. I agree with Peter about the overlay of the oppression of the immigration system, but you can't really walk down any street in Skid Row and not be struck by how much it does look like parts of the third world where it's not only economic oppression, but racial oppression.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I was reading on as I was preparing for this discussion, there was a point, and I can't remember where I ran across it, but there was a point where they started referring to, I think the police started referring to the people who are approved for housing, but none are available. And they talked about the impact of gentrification. But then they turned around and they said, well, actually, these people are service-resistant people. What the hell does that mean?
That's an invention of people who deliver bad services. If someone refuses a shelter or a service that anyone, you or I, would accept, that's a pretty good indication that it's a real thing. But many of the services have so many rules and so many just practical problems for homeless people that it's actually a rational choice to stay on the street. I have only encountered one person in 35 years of working on this who persistently has refused actual housing. But the rates of acceptance in lots of experiments, unfortunately at the level and the size of experiments, have shown that if you offer people actual housing, meaning even only just a room with a door and a key, 100% of them will take that. That was the county's experience with their Project 50. So service resistant is a way of blaming the victim, which we do, obviously, a lot of in this area.
Now, Peter, one of the things I wanted to ask you is that, you know, there was a 2007 court settlement. I think we referred to this earlier in the discussion, but it says the city says that it's constructed enough housing to actually legally resume its campaign to drive the homeless from the streets. Apparently, back in 2007, they were told they couldn't drive the homeless from the streets because they didn't have the housing to put them in. Now they say that they do have it, and so they'll be able to resume their campaign, or they're on their way, well on their way to having it. So then that allows them to resume the campaign to actually carry out this intimidation and terror.
I think that that's very misleading. In, I think it was in 2014 that the chief officer of Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles, estimated that something like $87 to $100 million was spent on homelessness in Los Angeles. But when you drill down on those numbers, it turned out that approximately $9 out of $10 went to law enforcement. So it's really going to the militarization of the problem rather than to solving the problem. What we increasingly see is sort of the privatization of public space and the subsidization of new exclusive enclaves that they often call urban villages. And these are driving more and more people, including mostly families of color, low-income families, immigrant families, into homelessness. The numbers are increasing all of the time. The options for these folks are decreasing all of the time. And the response of the city of Los Angeles has largely been a law enforcement response. Los Angeles has, as a matter of deliberate policy, has fewer public lavatories than any other major North American city. They have bulldozed most of the public toilets on Skid Row. And the police, lobbied by downtown merchants and developers, have broken up, as we know, they've broken up almost every attempt by the homeless and their allies to create safe havens or self-governed encampments. We saw not that long ago where Justiceville, founded by the homeless activist Ted Hayes, was roughly dispersed. So that's the problem that that we face. It's a problem of both a city council and a mayor's office that are unwilling to deal with the problem by providing anything close to the amount of temporary housing that's needed. And instead of pursuing this militarization approach, I think L.A. City and the county should enact and should implement a right to shelter mandate that ensures temporary emergency shelter to every man, woman, and child every night. And this is a fundamental human right that has been ignored. The problem, obviously, is linked to poverty, and those issues have likewise been ignored at a federal level, a county level, and a city level.
Gary, we have about a minute left. Do you want to add anything to this?
Well, a couple of things. One is the level of the city's commitment to actually help homeless people works out to one penny per day per resident of the city of Los Angeles. That's a level of commitment. And Peter's right. Out of $100 million that in 1 year the city spent dealing with homeless people, $87 million of that went to the police. And frankly, if you go to city council meetings, other than some fantastic community organizations like the Community Action Network, you don't hear enough opposition from ordinary citizens. You see the lobbyists for the developers and the yuppies and the hipsters complaining about homeless people, but you don't hear very much from the broader community of progressives, and I hope that will change.
All right. Gary Blasi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Peter Shea, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Definitely. Talk to you guys again. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Gary Blasi, a professor of law emeritus at UCLA and an advocate and researcher on homeless issues in Los Angeles since 83. And we've been talking with Peter Shea, who's the president and executive director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law Foundation since 1980, talking about the police assault, the state assault on the homeless in Los Angeles. All right, well, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. Yeah, Teddy, welcome back, man. It's been a while. And my production assistant, Jeff Pryor. I also want to thank each and every one of you. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And right now, I want to get serious again for a minute, all right? On July 17, 2014, police approached Eric Garner, a 43-year-old black man, a father of six, on a sidewalk in Staten Island, New York City. As police accused him of selling loose cigarettes, Lucy's, untaxed cigarettes, Eric Garner told them to leave him alone. Sick and tired of constant harassment, Eric Garner declared, "It stops today." As captured on video, a plainclothes cop put him in a chokehold. The cop pushed Eric Garner's face into the ground while four officers piled on Garner, who repeated, "I can't breathe," 11 times while laying face down on the sidewalk. Eric Garner lost consciousness and lay on the sidewalk for 7 minutes while the police poked at him and joked around. He was pronounced dead at the hospital. The New York City Medical Examiner's Office ruled Garner's death a homicide, but the Staten Island District Attorney led a grand jury to exonerate the murderers. This song is by the Peace Poets. It came out right around that time, and it's a song that's about standing up and saying no to this heinous act of slow genocide that could very quickly turn into a fast genocide. It's a song that's meant to build community. It's meant to bring people together to stand up and say together, no, not just that it stops, but we're going to stop it. So here it is, "I Can't Breathe" by the Peace Poets. And wherever you are, sing this song. Think of Eric Garner and think of the many, many more that have followed him. And sing this song with all your heart, all right? Whether it's in church, on the bus, among your friends, sing it out. Take a stand. Say, "This stops now." So we're going to go out now with "I Can't Breathe" from the Peace Poets. So talk to you again next week.
I still hear my brother crying, "I can't breathe." So now I'm in the struggle singing, "I can't leave." We called it out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't going to stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free. I still hear my brother crying, "I can't breathe." So now I'm in the struggle singing, "I can't leave." We called it out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. Stop till our people are free. I still hear my brother crying, "I can't breathe." So now I'm in the struggle singing, "I can't leave." We calling out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free.